Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland, and a very happy new year. As we hit the post-Christmas slump that is the beginning of January, it seems prime time to settle down in front of the television. But what to watch? Well, we've enlisted the help of arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph, Alice Vincent, and TV critic for London Live and The Evening Standard, Toby Earle, to help us sift through a few shows coming out of the UK this month. So that's your evenings covered, but what about your commute? Well, podcast reviewer Pete Norton will be on hand to give us a few recommendations of what to listen to in 2018 as well. And we'll also have a look at this week's Global Countdown with Fernando, of course. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Alice and Toby, welcome to the program as ever. Happy New Year to you both as well.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Now, how were your celebrations to begin with?
Mine was surprisingly restorative and deeply pleasant.
Wow, what a beautiful description as well.
Yes.
And Toby?
Mine were in a tin and you could open the lids and there was a selection. Miniature heroes also available, of course.
Well done. All right. Now, I think we do need to talk about television for obvious reasons. This is the Monocle Arts Review. How about Christmas television, though? It was a bit of a mixed bag, wasn't it?
In terms of numbers or TV available for viewing?
Well, I suppose in terms of quality entertainment, quality Christmas specials?
Well, I think on Christmas Day itself, you have now the standards. You have the shows which are expected to be there. So that's Doctor Who, Call the Midwife, Mrs. Brown's Boys, and those the kind of planks to the Christmas schedules. And I'm talking about the BBC here because their offering is obviously in excess of what pretty much every other channel puts out on that day in terms of original programming. It's come out that Call the Midwife is the most watched show of the day. It was Mrs. Brown's Boys. It was, yeah.
But on iPlayer.
And then cumulatively it becomes
Banner in the Works.
Watched, which is quite good news.
Big thumbs up there for those playing.
Big thumbs up because, you know, originally it was Mrs. Brown's Boys, the most watched show. Of course, the one metric which cannot be applied to Mrs. Brown's Boys is how many of those viewers are captive in terms...
Or asleep.
Well, I was going to say...
Snoozing off the lunch.
Captive in that they are not in control of the remotes. They are their parents or grandparents, and they have to sit there and absorb whatever they're being presented with.
Yeah. Indeed, I mean, we are talking British television today, so it does make sense to bring up the fact that this was the first Christmas, I suppose, that we didn't have the Great British Bake Off on the BBC.
On the BBC, yeah.
True.
Yes, it had shifted over to Channel 4, and there was the familiar Christmas Bake Off special that I did manage to catch a glimpse of, but as you suggest, Alice, I had a few too many portions of Christmas dinner by that point, and watching a show all about baking probably wasn't the best thing to be doing at that point.
It's just a bit glutinous, really, isn't it?
It was a little bit, yes. All right, let's move along, because we do need now to talk about Black Mirror. We are looking ahead into January, and one of the things that returned to Netflix, not The Crown, of course, over the festive period, was Charlie Brooker's Dark Anthology series. It is the fourth series of the programme that imagines the effects of technology on humans, and often creepily. So, Alice, is this a return to form for the show?
It is not. Spoilers!
Oh,
you know, it was going to happen at some point. What Charlie Brooker has done with Black Mirror is, for a start, you know, he eked it out very slowly. So it started with the first season was on Channel 4, it was only 3 episodes long, and there were just these drips and drabs every year, and it rapidly gained this cult following. It was this kind of critically acclaimed golden goose. He could do no wrong. It was smart. It was eerily prescient. It was precise and artistically filmed. And he kept offering different genres and bringing different writers. And it really was wonderful. And there's only so long you can keep that up for. Now, don't get me wrong. This season is still very good TV. It's not as good as the first Netflix season, which aired last year, and also to a certain extent those first incredibly visceral episodes he put out on Channel 4 about 5 years ago.
Well, this is the danger of an anthology series, especially like this one, where you've got individual stories with every episode, is that people will often compare, oh, I really, really liked that one, or not so much that one. It is interesting when you think back, the earlier episodes, the one involving the pig and the Prime Minister, I think a lot of people will remember. And then you consider San Junipero, something
that's a little bit more recent. Absolutely astonishingly beautiful to look at. It really, it feels like a feature film. It doesn't feel like something we're used to seeing on the small screen at all. Toby, I suppose, how do you see that sort of danger, this pitfall, I suppose, that series can fall into when, if we're doing individual stories, we don't have any long character arch to keep people entertained. Eventually, it's just going to fall off a cliff of some type, isn't it?
Well, it all depends as to the continuing quality of and quality control of those stories. And Alice rightly makes the point that when it first arrived on Channel 4, three episodes long, they took their time. They were doled out over quite a period, or at least it felt like quite a long period between each series, even if it wasn't. Such was the quality, such was the strong hit rate that those early series had. I'm holding myself back from watching this latter half of this series simply because there's only so much dystopia I can handle in a single year. And I'm trying to ration out my sadness. And I don't want to kind of just spend it all on the first couple of days of 2018 and then spend the rest of the year looking bleakly into a mirror with all the glass smashed out. I'm trying to kind of just have a little bit of normality in my life for a brief period. Then, of course, Donald Trump starts talking about having a bigger nuclear button than Kim Jong-un. And then, of course, nothing really makes sense anymore. But yes, there is, you know, like you say, Ben, you know, the when you have no long character arcs, it does come down to the writing and to the stories. And in the first half of this Netflix series, I thought San Junipero was exemplary.
Yeah.
Nosedive, the very first...
Also very, very good.
First episode.
And funny and...
Funny and believable. This kind of constant need to rate experiences, a constant need to... define a quality, to define everything in a qualitative nature which can be immediately shared and numerically understood by all.
To the extent that it's already starting to come true in China, they've got a system there where people are ranked and that directly impacts the access they have to things in society.
Mm. I think that's the genius of Black Mirror. You can watch so many episodes and think, oh, that seems a bit far-fetched. Oh, hang on. It's already happening in this other kind of way that's just not expressed quite like that.
And so what's funny is that Brooker himself has said that it's not, they don't think of a technological aspect which they then build a story around. They don't do that. They're not looking to just kind of think, whoa, what would happen if this was to take place? Obviously, you could argue in something like Nosedive, they clearly have, but they're not looking for that kind of prescience in every single episode. What I've noticed about this half of the series, though, Alice, I don't know if this is how you found it, the one everyone seems to be talking about is USS Callister, this sort of take on Star Trek and sci-fi.
Yes.
Is that the standout?
It is absolutely the standout. So it's also, I mean, the because they're anthology, you can watch them in whatever order you like, but USS Callister is also the first episode that comes up when you go onto Netflix. It's also the longest. It's an hour, it's 75 minutes or so, and it is exactly as Toby describes. The interesting thing is, so the first thing I did after watching it was go onto Reddit and read the Reddit description of it, and the take that Reddit has is extremely on the side of the main character, which everybody else watching is kind of like, wow, he's the antagonist. And that was very, very interesting to see that take. And that is where Charlie Brooker's genius lies, in that he has just punctured the entirety of gaming and gaming culture and white patriarchy and bullies. You could even extend it to Trumpian figures, and he is doing all of that within an episode that is so funny it will genuinely make you laugh out loud. When it's good, Black Mirror is very, very good, and it will change the way you think, but that isn't necessarily what I want from my TV viewing all the time.
Well, let's hear a clip now. This is the trailer to the episode titled Crocodile, where a woman with a device that reads people's memories discovers a little more than she bargained for in the mind of someone else.
Memories can be subjective. They may not be totally accurate, and they're often emotional.
I don't remember anything. It's a total blank.
Picture what you saw. Did you see the vehicle that hit the pedestrian?
I didn't see the actual crash.
Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
What does that do?
This accesses your memories of what happened. I don't care what you do in your own time. Private stuff is private stuff.
Well, Alice, suitably daunting sort of sounds there we hear in that clip. I know you've spoken about your disappointment from the series so far. How do you feel about looking forward into the future of Black Mirror, though? Are we getting to a point where perhaps it's just getting to the end of its line? Or, I mean, really, we're talking about individual stories. Maybe there is no end. Maybe this can go on forever. It just needs to pick up a bit. How do you see it?
I think what's really telling is that the two episodes that have been plucked out as the standouts from both Netflix series are San Junipero, as you mentioned, and USS Callista. And both of those have technically happy endings. And I think increasingly with a political and geopolitical landscape that is fairly bleak, people don't necessarily want to watch TV that is quite so profoundly depressing. And I think that actually someone with the talent of Brooker and his writing team could portray or mirror our humanity in ways that doesn't have to be quite so existentially terrifying.
But knowing what we know about Charlie Brooker, perhaps that's going to go against what he feels like he wants to be writing.
Possibly, although he has, it's worth noting that he's written both San Junipero and USS Callista. He doesn't always write the really depressing ones. He's got this kind of, this trope of being a grumpy, cynical man. I'm not sure he is all the time.
Well,
are you Charlie Brooker? Let us know.
Yeah, we really love to know. Come on the show, Charlie Brooker, or at least come around for lunch. Black Mirror is available on Netflix now. Now, staying on the streaming platform, let's talk now about, cover your ears, everyone, The End of the Fucking World. This originally aired last October. I know, I just swore on the radio. I can't believe it. It originally aired last October on Channel 4 right here in the UK, but this week has hit Netflix for international release. Alice, what's it all about?
The interesting thing about The End of the Fucking... Ooh, it feels a bit rash, doesn't it? about this show is that it's got barely any digital footprint. Like, I found it on Channel 4. Channel 4 ran it. It is a series of 8 episodes, 20-minute long episodes, based on a 2013 comic book by a man named Charles S. Forsman. And it is essentially... Watching it made me feel of, like, Wes Anderson if he'd Broken Bad. It's got a whimsical, kind of dystopian, but it's a whimsical coming-of-age story about two messed-up, bored teenagers in the suburbs who go a little bit rogue and go on a kind of really bad concept of a road trip. I find it delightful and very entertaining. I'm fascinated to see how Netflix reacts to it, because already the US entertainment press are very excited about this shock release that Netflix announced just yesterday. It's coming out on Friday. But there are barely any reviews, there's barely any coverage, the Wikipedia page is a sentence long. So I'm really intrigued how they're going to find what is a particularly bleak sense of British humour.
So far from what I can hear, this sounds like a lesson in how not to do marketing. But why is this arousing so much curiosity? And why then, if people are so curious, why have there not been, I don't know, more of an effort to make more out of it then?
You know, I think it might be due to the fact that it was one of these TV shows that was released quietly on Channel 4. It's a short, sweet little series. It doesn't have any landmark actors in it. It's two very young stars. People may recognise Alex Lawther from playing the young Alan Turing in The Imitation Game and Shut Up and Drive, the Black Mirror episode that was released last year. It's got a very recognisable face. I don't know why it's not done better, but it has the sort of components of all of my favourite shows. There's a lot of Utopia, the Dennis Kelly Channel 4 show that was around a few years ago. And that was interestingly always kind of mooted for an HBO pickup and has never been. But yeah, it's really curious. I think maybe just because Netflix are showing it and it's a new show and it's January and they've... I think that's why people are excited. They should be. It's good.
I do. My vision of Channel 4 is that you can kind of get away with a little bit of strangeness on Channel 4 that you won't necessarily find in many other places. And that strangeness is sometimes very, very British in its approach as well. Now, there have been comparisons made to between this series and perhaps a film that Ben Wheatley could have directed.
Yeah. Or Edgar Wright, similarly.
Well, exactly. Mm. And they sort of carry this sense of Britishness that to me is quite hard to explain, but you know it when it's there.
Yeah.
Do you get that from this series?
And, absolutely.
I mean, does it become a bit too much then? Sometimes.
Watching it, I was thinking, the American audiences, I'm not sure whether they're going to get that. Like, that sounds very condescending, but I was sitting there watching it by myself, both binging but also feeling like, oh my God, I'm so uncomfortable for you. This is so uncomfortable. And that to someone who really relishes awkward, uncomfortable moments. There's a lot of kind of dead silences and the relationships of the parents. And there's this sort of slightly hinted at weird nascent relationship between the teenage girl character and her stepdad. Like, there's a lot of really uncomfortable, not very nice things in there. And yet it is still whimsically great. Well, I sound like a terrible person now.
No, you're just making me awkward and uncomfortable, actually. Let's hear a little bit of a clip of this. This, of course, is the end of the fucking world.
School was beneath me, but it was a good place for observation and selection. I had a plan. I was going to kill someone.
Hey?
I've seen you skating. You're pretty shit.
Fuck off.
Working all day with my mind on fire. I can't stop thinking of you.
I kind of think I could fall in love with him.
I thought she could be interesting to kill, so I pretended to fall in love with her.
Walking all day with my feet on.
This is nice.
What is?
I thought probably he was gay.
He does, prick. Let's leave this shithole town. I'm going whether you come with me or not. You in?
I didn't know where we were going or when I was going to kill her. I punched my dad in the face and stole his car, and that felt like a good place to start.
Okay, so there's nothing like a folky guitar soundtrack to make you realise that you're in a road trip. Just finally on this, Alice, tell us a little bit more about the two lead actors, because of course when you're talking about a curious show like this one, everything depends upon the chemistry of the cast.
Yes, and the whole point of this couple in particular is that she's a lost teenage girl with a bad home life who desperately wants to sort of fall in love just to do something. He thinks he wants to kill her. I think even from the outset, it's quite apparent that he doesn't really have the capability of killing anyone. They're not meant to have any chemistry, and yet they're both so watchable. They are exactly the right measure of, like, believable outcasts. You know that thing that, like, even Stranger Things to a certain extent, they'll show on TV, like, the nerdy kids at school, and they're always, like, ridiculously good-looking and
yeah,
capable.
Yeah, yeah. Very handsome, just you know, bad hair and some ugly glasses.
Yeah, like, these are the kind of kids that, you know, you could believe that there's some acne hiding under their fringe. And and that's no dissent to the actors at all, who are both good-looking people. They're just believable and they're real, and they're the kind of kids you can imagine hanging out at a bus stop, and I think that's why it works.
It feels very much like a British Badlands, that kind of dynamic between the two leads, although slightly obviously more comic, like you say, I think perfectly described as believable outcasts. But what I really have liked about the show is that it doesn't care if you don't like it.
No,
it makes absolutely no concessions to the viewer whatsoever. And there's a scene right in the very first episode where the two leads are sat on a sofa, and he has a knife hidden under the cushion. And it's like that. Are we gonna kiss now? You know, when that first teenage date thing, do I put my arm here and he's holding a knife, and then think, and it doesn't care if you don't like its attitude, it seems to carry that through, which I find refreshing. But I agree with you,
what Netflix gonna make of it,
and other nations will make of it.
Time to tell.
Want to know if they're going to blank out the naughty word in the title.
There's many asterisks abounding around the internet right now.
Oh, I can imagine. Mm. Well, that is the end of the fucking world. It's out now on Netflix. For our final two TV choices, we turn to the BBC now. Hard Sun is the latest crime drama from the British broadcaster and has been produced in collaboration with the US streaming service Hulu. Let's hear a clip.
DCI Charlie Hicks. Lane Rankin is joining us as your new DI. So why are you here?
Hackers accessing inside information to order.
So what's on here? What's worth killing for?
What is on that flash drive?
I need to know.
So that's Hard Sun. Toby, set up the plot for us.
So this, as you will have heard there, features Charlie Hicks and Elaine Renko, played by Jim Sturgis and, dan, 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 Agnes Dean, once the doyen of catwalks, now a proper official actor. They stumble across a flash drive during a murder investigation. And on this drive, there is data which suggests, or even you would take from that trailer, admits to an extinction level event within 5 years. It's called Hard Sun, and what this is being touted as is a pre-apocalyptic drama. So it's not happening now. It's happening in 5 years. The show doesn't skip forward to 4 years and 11 months and 30 days. It is 5 years from now. And the implications of what such information would have on you, me, them, to quote the Blues Brothers, everybody, because what the very first episode, and it begins on the BBC this coming Saturday and will be on Hulu no doubt in the near future as well, is that they have this information in their lap, and everyone who's seen it is either dead or is in the process of being killed, because they know the authorities do not want this information escaping into the public domain. What this does, I don't want to give too much away, because there's a lot of fun to be had with this series. I mean, say fun, I mean, we're all going to die. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's actually the end of the world, just without so much swearing.
Thankfully,
yeah. And so what do these police officers do with this information? And they try to sort of insulate themselves from the repercussions of owning such information, which is, like I say, an imminent death, because security services don't want this information leaking out. Of course, I don't want to give too much away, but what would happen, for example, if this information was publicised by a media organisation, was suddenly put out there? I'm going to let you imagine what would happen.
I'm already terrified just hearing you talk about it.
I'm wondering who would believe it. How would you make someone believe such a thing?
So that's what they play with. They play with the idea of the conspiracy theories which exist on the internet now, and have done for quite some time. But now, conspiracy theories flood into mainstream talk. I mean, on my way here, I read a story about Eric Trump saying that Ellen DeGeneres might be part of the deep state. Now, that is just as ludicrous as it sounds, right? But this is the problem. These nonsense theories are being spouted from all angles, from positions of authority, and sifting through this becomes harder and harder. But what happens when people believe that? And what happens when their reactions are violent and are life-threatening to them, to the people around them? And this is what it looks at. And this is written by Neil Cross, as who wrote Luther. And there is no iconic coat in this so far as yet. But
Aggie Dean's got one shoved in her handbag somewhere.
Well, so maybe she's got the skinhead, she's got the cropped hair, she's got a hoodie, she's a little bit down, she's a working police officer. So there's no one clattering around in heels. This is not Jurassic World when someone's running from a T-Rex in high heels. They are functional human beings, but the first episode sets the premise up very, very sweetly, I feel, and doesn't really kind of get into that sort of the core of the story and what it's all about. About 25 odd minutes in or so, I watched the second episode, and the second episode then does begin to look at what happens if certain people believe what is being said, they believe what's being heard, and their reactions. Of course, this being written by Neil Cross from Luther, if you've watched Luther, you know that Luther's cases involve some quite imaginative ultra-violence, and that is the kind of domain he's playing in here. And so you do have those Luther tinges, while at the same time you have these two police officers trying to stay alive, trying to stay one step ahead of the authorities.
Well, I suppose some might say that we were already tricked into believing the end of the world was nigh back in whenever that was, that Orson Welles presented a certain radio drama. But Alice, let's talk a little bit about this kind of concept when it comes to mainstream television. As Toby says, this is from the people behind Luther, but this is a rather more, shall we say, ambitious sort of plotting. Are you one who can embrace this kind of somewhat outlandish plot on the small screen?
Absolutely. I mean, if anything, overly so. I still, when Toby, I'll just be sitting there like awake at night. Toby, about 10 minutes ago, was saying that he doesn't know how much more dystopia he can handle. And I agree with that. Like, I'm still recovering from last year's Handmaid's Tale. Mm. And that's as someone who is very familiar with the book and rereads a lot in general. But And it was seeing The Handmaid's Tale with music and signals of modern life that I could literally date to my own, and being like, oh my goodness, one day someone's going to walk into work and just tell me I'm fired because I'm a woman. Like, I think this stuff is increasingly believable, and I think it's deeply reflective of what's happening in the world at the moment.
Absolutely, especially in the case of breakfast television. Hard Sun starts on the 6th of January at 9:35pm on BBC One. It will be available on Hulu from early March. Now, let's end things now, not apocalyptically, of course, with a bit of black comedy in the form of Inside Number 9. This is the fourth series of the British show. Toby, for the uninitiated, what's the idea behind it all?
Well, to sort of flip back to the very beginning, Black Mirror's now anthology series. Inside Number 9 is an anthology series brought to you by Steve Pemberton and Rhys Shearsmith, a half of the League of Gentlemen. These are all standalone stories. They all take place inside or to some extent feature the Number 9. So we've had houses, we've had karaoke rooms, so that are number 9. So everything takes place, as the premise, within a particular numbered environment, or at least close to one. This series is just so spectacular in the breadth of genre and stories it aims to tell over each series run. It is flabbergasting in many ways that it hasn't won more awards, and I think that's probably down to it just never quite happily sits in a category for us people who like to have things categorised easily. There's comedy, there's drama, there's pathos, there's horror, and so as a consequence, I mean, it won at the it won the Rose Door for Best Comedy in 2016. But as a, you know, as a consequence of its own imagination and daring, it can't be pigeonholed, and so therefore doesn't have the row of statuettes that it frankly deserves. Well, as we record today, last night saw the arrival of the first episode of the new series called Zanzibar. The bar has been set so high because Zanzibar takes place in the corridor of a hotel, and it is a homage to Shakespearean farce. It is written in iambic pentameter, so it is a Shakespearean farce in modern London, with people crisscrossing through hotel rooms, mistaken identities, and a kind of drive the central story. And it has a ludicrous cast. Tanya Franks is in there, Bill Patterson's in there, Pemberton, Shearsmith, and then you have Helen Monks, who's terrific, and then you have Rory Kinnear, not once but twice, because let's face it, if you're going to get Rory Kinnear, you've got to make him work. You use him as much as possible. So he plays two characters in this who look quite similar. It is just so rapid. I saw it last year at the BFI, and the audience was just electrified by this, because it is so, like I say, daring. It is so witty, and it doesn't try to it doesn't make any excuses for itself. It treats the viewer with respect and wants you to become part of this. It wants you to dive fully in. That's just the first episode. And there are still several to come.
Inside Number 9 is on BBC Two every Tuesday at 10pm. Thanks to Toby and Alice for talking us through the television today. And if that doesn't keep you occupied into the new year, then perhaps some podcast recommendations will. Producer Holly Fisher spoke to podcast and radio reviewer Pete Norton to find out what we should be wrapping our ears around in 2018.
First up is an enduring trope in podcasting, which is narrative-driven American journalism. And I think in some ways you could say that this subcategory is to podcasting a bit what the British invasion was to pop music in the 1960s, in that all the really big hits seem to relate in one way or another to this type of podcast. So obviously we've got This American Life, which has spawned Serial and S-Town, two of the biggest breakout hits of the medium period. Last year we had Dirty John, and we've had various other podcasts in this trope that have been really successful, and I think there's going to be more of that this year. Season 3 of Serial is due to land in 2018. Typically for Serial, they're being very tight-lipped about details of this. Ira Glass has said that it's going to be different from season 1 and season 2, which perhaps isn't very useful, but they've hinted that this season is not going to be about a criminal case, it's going to be about something else. So perhaps moving a bit more in the S-Town direction, but I think that's likely to make some waves. and could potentially be another huge hit if it is more compelling than Serial Season 2 was. I've been really, really enjoying Slow Burn, which is an ongoing podcast about Watergate from Slate. It's really beautifully put together. Lots of archival footage from the period in the 70s when Watergate was ongoing, and some really erudite and lucid observations from its host and producer, Leon Neyfakh. It makes a beautiful link between that turbulent era of American political life and the current one without being obvious or prescriptive about it. That's been a pleasure, and I think it's a great example of the ways in which American episodic audio journalism is really cooking in the States right now. Secondly, in 2018, I think we're going to see more original podcasts from the BBC. The BBC have been podcasting for a long time, since the very early days of the medium, but typically what they did is just repackaged a show that had been broadcast as a podcast. But what I think that approach has missed is the fact that podcasting actually is its own medium with its own particular qualities. And the BBC are just beginning to get around to the idea that maybe they could make some podcasts that are just podcasts and that might be different from radio shows. So they've had a few experiments in this which haven't been so successful, which have felt a bit leaden and broadcasty, but they really hit on something with Blue Planet 2, the podcast, which went out concurrently with that huge hit of a BBC TV series. And the way this podcast worked was that it immediately followed the broadcast of an episode of Blue Planet, and it was kind of like a behind-the-scenes sort of deep dive into the making of that particular episode and the ways in which it had come to be. And it was really kind of intimate and funny and quirky. They had things like, they had a beautiful detail about they wanted to know what font David Attenborough has his scripts written in. Things like that. You just got these little nuggets of detail and all how the divers had got down to shoot a particular marine shot. And it felt podcasty and a very clever adjunct to the TV series. And it was a smart way in which a digital-only product could augment and back up a big broadcast product. And I'm sure the BBC are going to be doing more of that, because this was definitely a hit. We've had a few hits in recent years which have just come out of left field, which I'm really encouraged by, because it's great when it's not just the big broadcasters or the big podcast production houses that are creating the hit content, that sometimes just a great idea can kind of bubble up and capture public attention. So last year we had Missing Richard Simmons, which is a podcast in which journalists went in search of this elusive American gym coach hero. Previously in the UK we've had My Dad Wrote a Porno, which I don't particularly like as a series, but there's no doubting its success and the fact that it was just a kind of a clever idea and that it really got people going. So I think, in the absence of a crystal ball, I don't have any idea what that show's going to be this year, but I look forward to it coming along. And in the meantime, I'll be listening to a brilliant strand from the Radiotopia network called Showcase, which puts forward short, limited run podcast series by makers who might not otherwise have got attention. And the idea of this show is to spotlight great podcast ideas. And they're just about to launch on this strand a really interesting Swedish production called Secrets, which is about the different ways in which people lie and hold things secretively from other people. I think that's a really clever strand in that it's going to contain lots of different short series, which any one of which could become a breakout hit in its own right. And finally, if I had to bet on a surefire hit podcast for 2018 beyond Serial Season 3, I put my money on Wolverine the Long Night, which is Marvel's first ever scripted podcast, which is launching this spring. And I think that's going to capitalize on a lot of the kind of fervent interest and fandom that Marvel already have, and hopefully move that kind of fantasy storytelling into an interesting space. They're talking about, everyone always cites wanting to be a bit like Serial, but they're talking about bringing elements of the kind of narrative journalism into this comic book podcasting space. So I think that's exciting, and that's hotly tipped.
Thanks to Pete Norton. And we'll end the show today, as always. It's time for the Global Countdown. Fernando Augusto Pacheco has jumped through the glass into the studio with me, Toby, Alice. We're all here. Happy New Year, Fernando.
Happy New Year, everyone. I'm always very discreet when I come into the studio.
Very discreet.
So sneaky like a cat.
Yes.
Fernando, while you were sneaking in, we did hear the very distinct sounds of some Puerto Rican music, I believe.
Exactly. Well, basically, I decided to choose Puerto Rico for the first Global Countdown of the year because, you know, last year we spoke about Despacito so much. And in fact, I realized, oh my God, I never looked at the Puerto Rican charts. That's
oh my.
We're putting a wrong right.
Exactly. And it's interesting, and I did mention this in the show before, that I said that Puerto Rico is the Sweden of Latin America in terms of music, because there's only like about 3.4 million people living there. And of course, it's kind of a, they have this, the official name is Uncompromised U.S. Territory. There's a specific name. Sorry if I said something wrong, you know. But they do produce quite a lot of good music there.
Quite a lot of drag queens, I think, for anyone who's a loyal viewer of RuPaul's Drag Race.
They have a solid hit rate.
It's true. There's always a Puerto Rican. It's true.
And they normally get through to the final three as well.
It's yeah, they have a glow. Impressive. There's a certain glow that you get if you're a drag queen there. That's very true.
Yes.
Yeah. Fernando, I wish we could talk about Puerto Rican drag queens, but instead we'll talk about the Puerto Rican charts. Tell us more.
Very quickly, we have clips for all the top five songs, but very quickly, one thing that you can see is a lot of reggaeton, of course, and a lot of trap as well, which is this kind of US hip-hop style from the South, I believe. So yeah, a lot of trap and reggaeton. The songs, I have to say, they sound very similar. I want to hear your opinion, guys. But shall we go for the first one?
Please.
It's number five is Romeo Santos and Nicky Jam and Daddy Yankee, of course, with Bella y Sensual.
I can see exactly what you mean, Fernando.
It's cool, and the title, of course, you know, beautiful and sensual. You know, that's recurrent themes from those.
Absolutely,
it's like Jean-Paul and Je T'aime got together.
Yes, that's an amazing description.
It's about time, really, when you think about it.
And basically, if you want to watch the video, you know, they're having a good night out in New York, looking for Bella and Sensual people, I guess. Number four, funnily enough, I said Bella and Sensual. The song is called Sensualidad, which is sensuality. So it is some kind of...
Well, it's literally called sensuality.
Sensualidad, sí. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I'm talking Spanish now. and again, there's lots of featuring. You know, it's not there's not a single song here that is just, let's say, Madonna or Justin Bieber. No, there's always a featuring. This time is Puerto Rican, is a very famous. He does a lot of trap as well, as I was mentioning. Bad Bunny and Prince Royce and J Balvin from Colombia. This is Sensualidad. La temperatura está pa calentarte. Hay mucho tras de ti, pero yo siempre gano. La bebé está dura y sin el cirujano. Viste de que hoy te voy a buscar temprano. Quiero que todos nos vean agarrados de mano. So, Fernando, I'm thinking that
listening to
the charts in Puerto Rico must be quite a calming and soothing experience. It's not calm. It is over here.
In fact, you know, I mean, maybe I'm going to say something completely wrong. I don't know if you look at the charts, it reminds me, I do love Europop, and it's definitely a different beat, but it's this kind of very easy beat, you know, so that's why I think those songs are such huge blockbusters. It's something, I don't know, it's so infectious in a way, so I can see why they work in a way. And they all have the same beat, which was the same thing with Europop.
It's exactly the right rhythm that needs to play when you've had approximately 2.5 drinks and you're not sure if you want to dance or not.
Yeah, because, I mean...
And you're suddenly, ooh.
Yeah.
Something but irresistible.
My only issue with that song, I don't find it a very sensual song at all, but, you know.
Oh, you need a bass up, mate. That's what it is. I think it's the bass. If you crank the bass up on that, hoik that up.
Maybe they'll turn it a bit more
top
sensual.
Top tips from Toby Elbert.
Thanks, Toby.
If you want to feel sensual, let me tell you.
Well, to number three is not, sorry guys, not a very sensual song again. But there's four artists on that one. My God, I'm sorry, I'm not even going to try to say their nationalities because there's quite a few Americans as well with Puerto Rican origins. It's De La Ghetto and Brian Myers and Darrell and Almighty.
Quite a squeeze in the booth.
Oof, I'm okay. Yeah. And the song is called Ojalá. Let's listen.
It's the perfect cruising music. Fernando, if everyone that in my neighborhood were Puerto Rican and loved to listen to their own charts, I probably wouldn't need to complain about noise ever.
No, absolutely.
Do you complain about noise?
No, I don't. I just gave myself a bad name on the radio, didn't I?
And this song, I think you can feel the trap I mean the music rhythm, not the But it's an alright song. But and shall I go to number two?
Please, let's. So so number two, I have to say, I'm sensing a theme here. This person has already been mentioned today.
Oh yeah, Bad Bunny. Again, he's back. But this time he's with American singer Becky G.
Becky G.
With My Otis.
Not to be confused with the other Becky, I suppose.
Or Becky Hill.
Becky Hill, I suppose. That's true, that's
Becky
true.
Becky with the good hair.
Becky with the good hair, there's the other one.
Right.
Yeah.
Specifically Becky G.
Let's listen to it.
A little bit more energy there, Fernando.
Yes. And do you know how many million people saw this video on YouTube?
How many million people? I have to say no.
883 million Whoa. Views. I mean,
that's crazy.
And I didn't know that song before today. I have to be completely honest with you. It's blockbusters, the Puerto Rican chart. You know? And I think they have a whole continent to play with, which is Latin America. You know, as I say, this the rhythm, the reggaeton is going to Brazil as well. It's coming to Europe, to the US. So, that I mean, basically the whole world is listening and helping with the views. And I even thought, oh, maybe it's the whole Latin America, some Argentinian singers, Colombians, but no, the majority are Puerto Ricans.
Hang on, so that's been viewed by almost a seventh of the population.
Well, it might have just been one very overzealous person, but you know,
I would count
for some.
Their broadband bill.
Yes.
Woof.
But if you're impressed with that, the number one song has been viewed by 940 million.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So it's and I have to say, it is a good number one. It's by Ozuna, he's from Puerto Rico, and Nati Natasha, she's from Dominican Republic, a little change here. And the song is called Criminal, or Criminal.
I mean, I really need to visit a Puerto Rican dance club.
I like
it's a banger and a half, isn't it?
It's more reggaeton, you know. I kind of like, it's more suave, you know. It's not so like boom, boom, you know. And the clip as well, if you like the idea of a sexy prison, you should watch the video. So, you know, as you can see, the title of the song, Criminal, but...
So many images jump to mind.
Yeah, sorry, guys.
How does it compare to the sexy prison that Lady Gaga is confined in during the telephone video?
Well, that prison was quite fabulous. It's not quite there, but
it's a bit grittier.
It's jailhouse a bit grittier.
Rock. Is it jailhouse rock kind of prison?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's no cokes in the...
No coke in the... Yeah, maybe less product placement. Yeah, yeah. It's not very sexy as a look goes, to be honest. Like, excuse me, I just get that coke can out.
Coke can, yeah.
Fernando, thank you so much for guiding us through that. And for Fernando's full list of sexy prisons, you'll have to tune into another program, I'm afraid. Because that, of course, brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guests, Alice Vincent and Toby Earle. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando. My name is Ben Ryland. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, let's play things out with some more of that irresistible number one song from Puerto Rico. This is Criminal. Y se ponga así salvaje, baila mueve.